Radio Gorgeous presents Gorgeous Lives. Imagine interviewing rock stars, the Rolling Stones, Bob Geldof, Annie Lennox, Simple Minds. That was Christiana Backer's job at MTV. Parties, gigs, rock concerts, filming and travelling. Christiana always knew there was an emptiness inside her. She started to date the famous cricketer Imran Khan and her life changed forever. From MTV to Mecca is Christiana's spiritual journey. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So you describe yourself as a European Muslim. What does that mean?
Well, I'm European. I'm German by birth. I live in London and I happen to be Muslim.
You're putting the word European, so does that mean that you are different to other Muslims?
I mean, normally you associate Muslims with the East, but you see, Islam really is a religion for all times and all worlds, and people often think there's a conflict between Western values and Islamic values, or European values, and or British values and Islamic values, and actually there's no conflict at all. Islamic values are British values. Our European values. It goes well together. You know, what are European or British values? You know, it's honesty, fair play, rule of law, perhaps environmental consciousness, at least in Germany. You know, things like that. And all that is also what the Quran tells us to be and to do. I mean, it is not European or British to get drunk and to eat lots of pork and womanize. You know, this has become part of our culture. It's not the defining, not the essence of our culture. So that's why, you know, I'm very happy to have discovered that I can live very well as a European Muslim somewhere, anywhere in Europe. In fact, probably better than in the East, because at least here we have the rule of law. We have free education for everybody. We have healthcare for everybody. You know, these are all Islamic values, and a lot of Muslims have recognized this. They actually can live a better life here. That's why so many have come here.
So you were an MTV presenter in the early 90s with a very, very glamorous job, meeting top people in music. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yes, it was great fun. When I came here in 89, I stayed with MTV till 96, and then I did NBC Europe also for another 2 years till 98. And yes, you know, I was new chick in the town. I had like several invitations a night, you know, from pop stars, film directors, music managers, you know, wherever something hot was happening, we were there to cover it or just to attend it. I met a lot of major players in the music industry and in the film business, you know, and befriended a lot of them. In fact, we were friends to the stars who came on our shows because we were not like investigative journalists. MTV was music television. Every musician wanted to be on it, you know, because that meant selling records. So often after the interviews, we hung out, we partied, we had drinks together, whether in Europe or even here, you know. It really was a very busy life. Work hard, party hard was our motto. And it was like a dream job. And, you know, I'm still grateful. I mean, whenever I now bump into anybody from the past, Duran Duran, Bob Geldof, you know, anybody like that, you know, we chat, we stop, you know, we reminisce about the past, whatever. It was great fun, you know, because there was only one MTV all over Europe. And so we were, you know, we were sort of celebrities in our own right at the time.
So then you met Imran Khan. What year was that then?
92. I met him in 92 at a dinner party. Susanna Constantine had a birthday party and he was my, you know, seated next to me. And he had a very different view about popular culture compared to the rest of the people at the table. For example, at the time we were discussing this film Basic Instinct that had just come out, which was a bit provocative. It was a bit like Wolf of Wall Street nowadays, you know, and everybody else thought, brilliant, it's so provocative, it shows all these scenes that, you know, haven't been shown before. And he said, oh, well, actually, this would be censored in our country, you know, and these are scenes that should be between husband and wife, you know, kept in private. And everybody thought that was a bit of a different, unusual view, you know, and it was fueled by his faith, you know, that intimate relations are between husband and wife, you know, not to be displayed in public. And then he also mentioned how he was going to give up his cricketing career. He had just won the World Cup for Pakistan, by the way, which I had no idea about because I don't have, we don't have cricket in Germany. And he was going to give it all up to become a charity worker, to build this hospital in Lahore, where poor people would be treated for free. And again, what an unusual career move. So it was an interesting encounter. And soon after, he asked me out to join him with some friends, you know, at Annabelle's, going out for dinner and so on. And I arrived in a mini dress. And he asked me if I wouldn't mind keeping on my coat all night. My coat over my nice dress, you know. Yeah. But anyway, I did it. And he explained, you know, in our culture, women don't show flesh. And, you know, it's about dressing modestly. And in fact, men also dress modestly, you know. And then thinking about it and reflecting on it, I fairly quickly got the point, you know. Why should women with their body try to get places, you know? Why do we always have to show cleavage, wear a mini, show as much as possible to win points? Even in business meetings nowadays, I wonder, why are women always half naked, kind of thing, you know, whereas men are fully clothed in their suits? That was my first the first thing that I changed, really, wearing longer clothes while I was working on MTV, because I realized, you know, a woman is actually more dignified when not showing off all the assets she has. You know, the entertainment industry, the motto is, if you've got it, flaunt it. But now I began to understand the concept of modesty, and I tried to juggle this, even now, faith and fashion, you know.
Tricky.
Gorgeous lives, living gorgeously.
Keep shining and stay gorgeous.
So he took you to Pakistan. You'd never been anywhere like this before. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, my first trip to Pakistan, you know, you arrive there, everything smells differently, you know, everybody is Pakistani, of course. It was an extraordinary journey. You know, it's a very rich country in terms of a very central country, very, you know, the colors are rich, the scents are intense, you know, are so different. I mean, Queen of the Night, this flower that blossoms at night, it's like this intense jasmine that, you know, that passes you by sometimes, or you get these jasmine bracelets, you know, people sell these, like all these wonderful scents, and, you know, and the food is so delicious. You gain a lot of weight over there. And people are very, extremely warm and hospitable, whether they're rich or poor. You know, I experienced the most amazing hospitality over there. And even now, you know, I just got back from a trip to Pakistan. I was just there for 3 weeks, and it was still as lovely as ever. And, you know, I mean, what really struck me at the time was when we traveled to the mountains, where people had nothing at the time, you know. Further than Gilgit, which was the most northern outpost of the British, further up into the Hindu Kush Mountains towards Hunza, where the anti-aging apricots come from, and Nagar. And, you know, over there, people had lived in houses built from mud and wood. They had no creature comforts, no satellite television, no hot water, no heating, nothing, you know, central heating, nothing like that. In fact, they lived above their animals. The animals were on the ground floor. People stayed above.
So it was like going back 2,000 years.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And in the month, so, you know, so then the body heat travels up and keeps the people warm. Yet when we walked through these villages, they offered us whatever they had in the name of God, you know, with a bismillah. Muslims do everything in the name of God. And it was so touching, you know, to see that. And in fact, wherever we stopped with a jeep, Imran was immediately surrounded by a few hundred people, or, you know, a lot of people. Yeah. And they all wanted a signed cricket bat or an autograph, you know, a photograph with him, that sort of thing. And a lot of them also dropped a few rupees into his hand. This is for the hospital. You know, they all wanted to be part of the hospital. And even people in rags gave a few rupees for the hospital, you know. Women took off their jewelry and donated them to the hospital, you know. Anybody wanted to be part of this project for the sake of God, to please God, you know, by doing charity, by doing something for a cause higher than themselves. And he used to say it's the poor people who build the hospital, not the rich. And it really was touching, this kind of friendship and faith come together for the sake of God, really, to do something like that. And anyway, in extreme hospitality of the people over there, whether poor or rich, it was a very moving experience in many ways. And we also listened to a lot of Qawwali music. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan is the most famous Qawwali musician. He achieved what no army soldier has ever achieved, and that is to unite India and Pakistan in adoration. Yeah, and people, you know, and he, I mean, listening to his lyrics, they're old ancient poems, you know, could be hundreds of years old. And they moved me more deeply than any pop song I heard on MTV, you know. And in fact, it was this music that opened my heart to the culture and religion of Islam. A lot of Muslims nowadays say, oh, music is forbidden, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, I like to tell them it was music that brought me to Islam.
Yeah. Did you feel different coming back? You know, was it a culture shock being back at MTV?
It certainly was, because in fact, days after my first trip, I went to La La Land, to Los Angeles, for the MTV Video Music Awards. And my God, you know, it was such a clash, such a culture clash, mm-hmm. because, you know, there I'd come from this country where women wear these really sort of loose clothes at the time. They're called shalwar kameez, a little bit more, you know, loosely fitting. And people had this inner light, you know, probably from prayers and so on, and this genuineness about them. And suddenly I was catapulted to this very fake world, you know, with a lot of plastic surgery and Botox and attitude and ego, you know, shades at night, people who wear glasses at night. And I mean, this whole rock and roll attitude, you know, and really short mini skirts and tight stuff, fitting clothes. And it was just, and people got just drunk and taking drugs and everything else. So, yeah, it was a bit of a culture shock, I must admit. And I started reading books on Islam by that time, and I was fascinated, you know. Mm-hmm. I always had a love for philosophy and ethics and so on. So I started reading and, you know, and reflecting. And, yes, I wasn't quite the same anymore, you know. Something had changed in me, exactly. Mm-hmm. I felt almost a stranger. Mm-hmm. I was beginning to feel a stranger in the setting, you know, where before was fully part of it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that just increased, I guess, that feeling, you know.
Yeah. You say you were into philosophy, but had you thought about spirituality before, or was this your first kind of awakening?
Well, I had thought of it just a little bit, you know. For example, Terence Trent D'Arby talked about spirituality, and I was kind of interested in. In fact, you know, I was interested even before, when I was a radio journalist in Germany, and I did a number of reports on spiritual matters, on the occult, and on witchcraft amongst, or in fact, the Ouija board and the occult amongst children and this kind of thing, you know. Yeah. I was always on the phone to the Institute of Paranormal Studies and interviewing the priest, this, that, and the other. So I had this interest, this fascination with the spiritual world, but it was completely unguided. And a friend from the radio station, actually, introduced me to Krishnamurti. And in fact, you know what, even as a student, when I was an exchange student in America, I went to visit the Osho Ranch, Bhagwan, Sri Rajneesh, you know. Mm-hmm. So there was an interest with this, the spiritual world, but it, as I said, was completely unguided. And really only when it was suddenly, you know, a focused introduction and in Islam, you know, through Islam, suddenly I began to read deeply into it and just go down that route, you know, and then find out more. What I was reading resonated with me and fascinated me. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to know more. You know, it wasn't like, oh, let me compare all the different religions. I mean, where do you start? You know, it's a study of a lifetime. So I didn't do that. I just was fascinated by what I read and I wanted to know more and, you know, asked more and more questions. So Imran and I, we shared books, we met scholars. You know, he was very patient, very patiently he answered all my questions, and we were always debating religious issues. It was fascinating, you know, I so enjoyed it.
Were you in love with him by this point?
Yes, I suppose after that first trip, that's where it happened, you know. Yes, so to say. You know, and so I wanted to know more about his religion, what makes him tick, what it is that he's so fascinated about. And it was contagious almost, you know. Mm-hmm. But I was obviously, I had something in me.
Yes,
so exactly. It resonated. Yeah. If I didn't have the seed in me anyway, it wouldn't have germinated. You know what I mean?
I agree. Your main question to yourself was, how can I combine, because you were, it was crossing your mind by this point, how can I become a Muslim, but, you know, carry on being a European? Just the kind of rules and regs, they must have kind of freaked you out a bit.
Of course, you know. Mm. And how can I be a modern woman working in the entertainment industry and become a Muslim? I mean, I really asked myself, is this compatible, you know, especially as a woman? And because I also only had the same prejudices as most other people have, not knowing much about Islam, you know.
So the women are covered up. The
Is it suppressive? Are women second-class citizens?
Yeah.
You know, is it encouraging violence, Islam, you know, and all these kind of things. So I had to really look behind the headlines and study all of this and find out the truth, you know.
So can you tell us some things? Because we are prejudiced.
Of course.
It.
Well, I can tell you this. I mean, how much time have we got? Yeah. You know, yeah, I mean, you know, there are these major stumbling stones, and I can say, of course, God always spoke the same message throughout time to different prophets. And with Islam, he completed the revelation, you know. So basically, he sent another prophet when people started going off track, kind of thing, you know. And Prophet Muhammad was the last prophet he sent. So it's the same message that he's always sent. Worship one God, be good to your parents, be kind, you know, and good to your neighbor, love your neighbor, you know.
Same as Christian, of course.
You know, mm-hmm. And so God wants us to live in peace and to be good to each other, you know, and live in harmony together.
Gorgeous lives, living gorgeously.
Women have to be covered up. Why are they different part of a prayer room? You know, why are some Muslim men don't want women to talk to other men? You know, what's all that about?
there's a minefield. Look, if men nowadays lived Islam the way Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, taught it, women would be the happiest of all the women, you know, the Muslim women. But unfortunately, a lot of cultural stuff comes in, you know, and
so it's been corrupted in time.
It has, of course. Yeah. Like everything else.
Christianity. Yeah.
Yes.
You know, I mean, women have only just been able to have mortgages in England since the 1960s. You know what I mean? We're not that.
Is that so?
Yeah. Really? You have to get your father to sign for it, or your husband.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, we're not, you know, we think, oh, we're really liberated, but it's very modern.
Very recent,
really,
yeah.
Very recent.
Yeah.
You know, even my mother was the 50s housewife, you know.
You see, exactly, of course, my mother too. And, you know, the thing is, in Islam, actually, women were given the right to vote whenever Islam was revealed, you know. And here in Europe, we had the right to vote also only fairly recently. So, actually, Islam came to liberate women. It came as a liberation and a protection for women. Prophet Muhammad was a women's rights champion, you can say, you know.
Wow.
However, of course, culture has tarnished things. So women at the time of the Prophet, you know, were contributing to the community. There were women scholars at the time, right, and also in early Islam, you know. But then as Islam spread, it started engulfing other cultures and women were pushed more and more into the houses. So this kind of suppression of women, almost you can say, is a fairly modern phenomena, and it's against Islam, I would say, you know. Look, the roles between women and men in Islam are according to the inner nature of a man and the inner nature of a woman. And, you know, women have children, men don't have children.
Yes,
so you can't change that.
Yeah.
It's a fact. And children need love and care and attention and stimulation. You know, you can't just have them and abandon them and so on. So Islam encourages that. But then as soon as the children are looked after, then women should be going out and doing things and becoming a contribution to society. A woman doesn't have to clean in Islam for the house or cook or anything. She doesn't even have to nurse her baby or breastfeed her baby.
Yeah.
However, that's what, of course, most people do. You know, so all I can say is, Islam or God loves women and loves men. And I wished that Muslims would practice properly, you know, their Islam, because that would be very advantageous and beneficial for women. So what I discovered very early on basically is to try and discern or decipher what is cultural and what is religion, you know, what is the essence of the religion.
Yeah.
And whenever I didn't like something, usually it was a cultural thing.
Mm-hmm.
It, like in women, in Saudi Arabia, women can't drive cars.
Yes.
It's not in the religion. It's purely cultural.
You're kind of exposing the myths.
I'm trying to, and I'm trying to say, you see, that's why, as a modern woman in Europe, I can live true Islam very happily.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, like I'm sitting with you now, you haven't got a headscarf on, and one of the first things I said to you before this interview, I said, you haven't got one. I mean, so when do you wear one?
Well, I wear my scarf for prayers, or when I am in conservative Muslim societies, you know, out of respect.
Yes.
But here, I feel always it attracts too much attention. And the point of wearing a scarf is...
The opposite.
The opposite. So it defeats the purpose if I wear it suddenly in London, you know, and or in Germany. I had enough sacrifices, by the way, when I became a Muslim. You know,
Can you tell us about that? So the German press went totally against you, didn't they?
Exactly.
Yeah, it sounds really horrible.
Yeah, it was very traumatic. Oh. I had no idea. I had 7 years of positive press, won some awards, you know, was this really popular.
Yeah, so it's like you're on a high.
I was on a total high, absolutely, after 7 years of, you know,
fantastic
of adulation
career.
And brilliant career. Yeah. And suddenly I became public enemy number one in Germany.
And what was the statement you made that turned them?
Well, they had done, my youth show in Germany was celebrating 100th show, and they asked me, have you already converted for your boyfriend? And I was surprised by this question, because I never admitted that I had a boyfriend, because in the culture, in Islam, of course, you cannot have boyfriend or girlfriend. In fact, you must be married. You cannot live together or anything like that. So out of respect for Imran, we never said anything official. Yeah. No, of course not. And so this journalist had obviously done his research very well and researched, you know, read the English papers or whatever. So I said at the time, I said no, which was the truth, but I'm a Muslim at heart. I was already there in my heart. I believed this. I felt like this. I dressed a bit more modestly. I wore longer clothes. And I believed this is the truth. I was fascinated. Intellectually, I was already convinced. And I had just not done the official step, you know, to say the declaration of faith and start praying and practicing, you know, it was just before. And you know, the first article in the German press was, oh, our Christiana, is she going to become First Lady of Pakistan and give it all up? Well, it didn't quite work out like that, but, you know, is she supporting terrorism? Has she lost the plot? Is she going to present her youth show from behind the burqa? I mean, one article after the next, ridiculing me, you know. And then I went onto this dreaded chat show, People Behind the Headlines, where I was just set up, you know, with a bunch of Islamophobes. And, you can live, you don't think you can live Islam light in London, it doesn't count. Well, why not? Plenty of Muslims here. Why can't you live Islam according with a European understanding? I mean, it was just, they made me look, anyway, it was really a setup. I mean, they had, you know, images of women in black burqas and men with Qurans and Kalashnikovs screaming Allahu Akbar, blood everywhere. Our MTV presenter Christiana, what do you like about that? And I go, Islam means peace and surrender to God. Next. They didn't want to hear anything good. And Prince Charles is very fond of Islam. Anyway, so it was a setup. And, you know, shortly after that, I lost all my work. You know, in fact, I had a freshly signed contract with my German youth show. They had begged me for months to host the show for another year. Suddenly, the contract was worthless and I was out. And what had been my crime? I'd become a Muslim. That's it. I didn't change, you know, didn't wear a hijab or anything.
Even though you'd had this painful experience, it didn't change your spiritual path. You became a Muslim.
Yes. Yeah. Straight after.
had to get there quickly.
I know.
Quick. God, I need you.
I needed the spiritual support very much at that time. Quite. And it was my newfound friends in faith who helped me through, you know, who helped me see the events from a spiritual perspective. You know, nothing happens without the permission of God, number one. And all the things that weren't good for me in the future were leaving me.
Yeah.
I mean, Imran had gone, you know, all my jobs had gone, you know, and here I was, a brand new Muslim who had to try and find herself, you know, as this new Muslim in Europe, in London. And it was really like starting again from scratch almost and sort of, you know, finding out who I am and how I'm going to do it.
I just need to ask, how did you and Imran finish? What happened there?
It's a long time ago. He kind of just vanished. He just vanished. It was heartbreaking. But he phoned 9 years later to apologize.
Good.
And apparently he'd been praying all throughout his marriage for me. And I only saw him a couple of weeks ago, and he told me the same, you know, again, and that he felt he suffered in his marriage because of the pain he, you know, caused me, you know. And anyway, so now we're friends. It's a long time ago.
You've come, I wish him
well. He gave me my greatest gift, and that is the faith.
And it was not meant to be. Your journey was a different one.
Exactly.
Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women. Over 1,000 followers can't be wrong. Follow us on @radio_gorgeous on Twitter, darling, of course. Mwah.
So I want to know what you feel like inside. You know, what is spiritual fulfillment?
Well, you know, first of all, that emptiness that you mentioned before is now filled with God. And it is filled with meaning, you know, with a purpose in life, you know, purpose to please God in whatever way I can, whether it is being good to my neighbor or, you know, helpful in this way or the other, or trying to promote dialogue, you know, between Islam and the West, or, you know, do whatever I can in my own way, you know, to be of a positive contribution.
What's the emotion? Well, as, I'd like to know the kind of actual, you know, feeling.
I suppose it's a it's something like a contentment. You know, there's an inner contentment that I didn't have before. Literally, this emptiness is not there anymore because I can sort of connect with God at any moment of the day, you know, and do a little bit of meditation, like we call it dhikr, remembrance of God, you know. Do like a mantra type of thing, you know. People are more familiar with mantras than with dhikr, I suppose. So, so, you know, so that's what I do. You know, you connect with God. I connect with God, you know, when I feel down or things are not working out or whatever, I pray to God. So I get my hope from God. I get my strength through the prayers, you know. And my gratitude as well, you know, when I express my gratitude when things are going well. So I have this inner connection, this inner dialogue. I don't feel totally alone anymore. Yeah. And, you know, when I do, when I suddenly lose it a little bit in terms of my high spiritual state or whatever, you know, and I open the Quran and start reading that, or I open books, you know, by this amazing sheikh, you know, from hundreds of years ago. It brings you back to the center. When you're out of sync, it brings you back to the center, and you kind of, your heart opens again, and you know, you suddenly, you, it makes click and some knots dissolve, and you feel tranquil again, you know, and content and full of hope that good things will come. So any, or even guilt, you know, when you do something bad by mistake, you know I have to ask for forgiveness, and I ask God for forgiveness, you know. By the way, also, it helps me to be 100% straight, because, you know, I know God doesn't like liars and so on, and you've got to be straight. I don't drink, I don't take drugs, you know, I gave it all up. and you know what? I have fun, I still have fun.
Yeah.
I just don't have the hangover that goes with it, with the other life.
Quite envious.
It's really remarkable. I never thought I would, but I get much more out of life nowadays, I find, because, you know, when everybody else gets drunk, I leave.
Yeah.
And the next day I'm fresh in the morning, fairly fresh, and the others are struggling.
Yeah.
And, you know, so much that I talk to people about, say at a party or whatever, they then forget the next day. It's all not there, just empty promises. It's just so much, again, nonsensical talk on drugs and on alcohol.
Can you tell us, because it's called From MTV to Mecca, you have been to Mecca, and what was the name of the kind of experience that you had? What was, you're going on a...
Well, I went on an Umrah, which is the small pilgrimage, and on the Hajj, which is the big pilgrimage, which is the Hajj, is you do it at a fixed time. It's, I think, 2-3 months after Ramadan. Once a year it happens, and 3 million people go on Hajj at the same time to do the different rites. You walk around the Kaaba, and you actually do the whole pilgrimage in memory of Abraham, our common father, grandfather, whatever, ancestor. And, you know, you remember Abraham's wife, how she was looking for water when she was put into the desert with a little baby, and suddenly they ran out of water. You remember the slaughtering, that, you know, Abraham was asked to slaughter his own son, and then it was changed into an animal. And, you know, He was so 100% obedient to God. And that is, in fact, one of the essences of the Hajj. Number one, this obedience to God, like Abraham, mm-hmm. who was ready to kill his own son with the permission of his son. But then, of course, it was just a test from God. And the other essence, I suppose, is forgiveness. Forgive yourself. Forgive anybody who's ever done you any harm. Forgive, just forgiveness, you know. Forgive others so that God will one day forgive you. And when you come back from the Hajj, you know, the big responsibility is to keep it. Because now you've been cleansed. Apparently, when the Hajj is accepted, all your sins are forgiven. And, you know, the task is to keep it, to not fall back into your old mistakes and so on, you know. You know, a lot of people wait till they're like 80 yeah. and then they go on Hajj. Life yeah. of sin, and then, oh, I'll get it all cleaned up. Well, that's a bit hypocritical, you know. Mm. Better to go young and then try and live a good life. As a Muslim and single, it means, you know, you don't have any relationships. It also means, of course, no alcohol and, you know, you eat certain halal food. So it really is, it takes a lot out of you kind of thing, you know.
And you only eat halal then? No.
Yeah, I try. I really do, 99%, I would say. But also, you see, it helps me to make the best out of me, keeping me focused, but also, you know, try and be, you know, good to others, try and speak good language, try and... You know, I mean, I don't manage it all the time, but I've got a high ideal to aspire to at all times.
And now, is that stressful, having a high ideal? Does that, like, think...
No, it's good. Mm. I find that really good. At least, you know, I have something to aspire to. And I think I'm a better person for it.
Have you changed?
I think so. Less selfish, you know, and try to...
Aware, I suppose. You're more aware.
And conscious, exactly. And also more sensitive, perhaps, towards others.
Are you a Sufi?
Well, first sign of someone who's not a Sufi is when they say, I'm a Sufi.
Okay.
So no, I'm trying. I'm trying to be on a spiritual path.
Can you explain what, you know, Sufism is?
It's the heart of Islam. It's the inner dimension of Islam. It's the spiritual dimension, you know. It's doing extra prayers and trying extra hard to ennoble your soul and ennoble your character, Islam, as we say. It's
But you say in the book that you were happy because when you went to the Sufi place, you met much more like-minded people and, you know, you could relate to it.
It was trial and error. I wanted to find a spiritual guide because here as a new Muslim, you know, without a Muslim family and so on, I needed a spiritual guide, I felt, you know, someone who can... teach me, you know, the prayers and what prayers to say when and, you know, and I still learn these kind of things from people who are ahead of me, you know, and it's so beneficial. I mean, I'm still such a beginner, you know. So, you know, it's the mystical dimension that you have in every religion, in Christianity as well and in Judaism, as the Kabbalah. If you read texts from the Kabbalah or Sufi texts, you can't even differentiate which is from what, you know. They are so similar, of course, because it's, again, it's both from God, you know, and that is what I love. I didn't subscribe or I didn't get to know the Islam of forbidden and allowed and, you know, fire and brimstone. No, it's that intellectual and spiritual approach, you know, the Islam of the heart. And that's what I love.
Fabulous. So what do you do now? Obviously, you know, before you were a TV presenter, what are you up to now?
Well, I'm trying to get back into TV. in discussions at the moment with a particular station, an international satellite station. I hope that'll work out, so I shall be back, possibly, inshallah, as they say, God willing. And otherwise, you know, I'm promoting my book. I had a phenomenal year so far. I was in Malaysia, in Singapore, and Hong Kong, talking about my journey to Islam, and in America twice. I spoke at Northeastern University and various other places. And I was in Pakistan for the first time in 17 years for 3 weeks. And it was phenomenal. I spoke at the Literary Festival and a lot of old friends, including Imran, you know, and Yusuf Slaudin from the book and everybody else, you know. So it was amazing. So I'm still doing the book very much. And otherwise, you know, I'm trying to build up some kind of a business, you know, sort of commodity property business type of thing to, you know, build up a sort of a second leg to stand on or whatever.
So, Christiana, what would you say your mantra for life is then?
Well, it's a very, very difficult question. I suppose follow your heart, you know, and keep the connection with God. Believe in God and do good deeds. trust in God. You know, he wants our best. And try and find your inner voice. In fact, your purpose, you see, your soul purpose. The purpose of your soul is your soul purpose, why you're here. You see, each and every one of us needs to figure out why they've been brought to this earth. What are they going to be remembered for? You know, what is the contribution you are going to make? So that's what I had to ask myself. And I think for me it is, you know, having been an MTV presenter, now becoming a Muslim, an adherent to the most misunderstood, most vilified religion in the West. So as a communicator, as a, you know, as a journalist by background, and as a TV presenter, media personality, whatever, it is my natural desire to try and build bridges, you know, and try and make Islam, I suppose, understood a little bit better here in the West. And also to inspire the Muslims themselves to have a more spiritual and intellectual approach to God, and neither to lose their faith nor to become all extremists. You know, I was shocked when I was promoting my book and I went, for example, to Blackburn, and you see so many women wearing niqab over there.
What's that
all about? The face veil.
Yeah.
Covering of the face, mm-hmm. and abaya, you know, whole sort of say, black bin bag kind of thing, you know. I mean, each to their own. I respect everybody, and I really also defend the right of a woman to wear a headscarf and wear whatever she likes. And I think it's wonderful that Britain doesn't ban the face veil or anything like that. But I do wonder who teaches the young people in Blackburn this kind of version of Islam. I have an aim, you know, to be inspirational, hopefully, to Muslims as well as Western people, you know.
From MTV to Mecca is published by Arcadia and Awakening Books. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It was really great.
Gorgeous Lives was brought to you by Radio Gorgeous Productions. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.
Keep shining and stay gorgeous.
ਸਾਡੀ ਤਾਂ ਮਸੀਤ ਵੱਖਰੀ ਓ ਸਾਡੀ ਤਾਂ ਮਸੀਤ ਵੱਖਰੀ ਮੁੱਲਾ ਤੇਰੀ ਨਾ ਮਸੀਤ ਅਸੀਂ ਆਈਏ ਸੁੱਖ ਕੁੱਲੀ ਯਾਰੀ ਦੀ ਦੇ ਮਾਰਦੇ ਅਸੀਂ ਹੋਰ ਨਾ ਸਵਰਗ ਕੋਈ ਚਾਹੀਏ ਸਾਡੀ ਤਾਂ ਮਸੀਤ ਵੱਖਰੀ ਮੁੱਲਾ ਤੇਰੀ ਨਾ ਮਸੀਤ ਅਸੀਂ ਆਈਏ
Radio Gorgeous presents Gorgeous Lives.